This is Wired magazine. This is a legit magazine. You guys heard of Wired?
Yeah.
Okay. He's written more than 16,000 songs, available on iTunes and Spotify. Are they any good? No, of course not. Can you believe that? I bet he listened to less than five. I think there should be daily headlines about me on every newspaper, like Matt Farley continues to exist. But the headline is always, this jokester spam artist has figured out how to cheat the system and steal money from Spotify. I'm like, is it cheating the system to put your heart and soul into a project?
You are listening to Fruitless, a podcast hosted by me, Josiah Sutton. This is episode 29, A Hollywood in Our Backyard, featuring Will Sloan. And welcome to Fruitless. I am Josiah, and I'm joined today by Will Sloan, co-host of both the Important Cinema Club and Michael and Us podcasts, and co-author of the definitive and only book about Moturn Media, Moturn on Moturn. Welcome, Will.
That's very kind that you would say that, but I hope it's not definitive. I kind of hope that it is for them what the book that Chabrol and who was it? Romare, I think, wrote about Hitchcock in the 50s. You know, they kind of got the ball rolling when Hitchcock was in mid-career. And, you know, there have been a million books since. And I kind of hope the same happens with Matt and Charlie.
I hope that's the case also. I hope that ends up being the case. I've been trying to get out of the habit of, we'll get to this in a bit, but not calling the most recent films the late period films.
Yeah.
Because it's the black and white period is what I'm trying to say instead of late period, because I don't want to apply this as toward the end, because I don't want this to be the end. And I'm kind of convinced with how committed they are to it that they're just going to be doing this until they're retired.
Well, they claim, I think Farley says that it's going to be 10 movies in 5 years, and if they don't start making any money on them at the end of that, they're going to slow the pace down a lot, which may be true, may not be true. I kind of hope it's not true. I mean, this period of incredible like productivity that they're on has been generating, I think, some pretty good dividends. I don't know. They seem like compulsive creators to me, and it seems like, you know, movie making is in their blood. So I suspect they'll be doing it till they die, and we'll see, you know, new generations of actors, you know, coming up in the ensuing decades as they grow older.
I feel like you see that in the last few movies of theirs too, that there's new actors coming in and like they're growing. But yeah, well, before we get that far, because I do want to spend a good amount of time on the most recent movies, because I think, I don't know, those are the ones I've been really interested in lately. But I'm assuming most people listening to this don't know what Moturn Media is. And so let's do this. So you've been kind of an evangelist for Moturn Media for the last few years a bit, right?
I consider myself kind of the John the Baptist of Matt Farley. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's your how I discovered them, and most of my friends who also know them are also Important Cinema Club listeners or Michael and us listeners.
You say that a lot of people might not know them, but it's odd. Matt in particular has a very strange kind of multi-tiered reputation, because of course as a songwriter, some of his songs have had millions of listens. Folks may be familiar with the Poop Song or Poop in My Fingernails or the Butt Cheek Song, and literally dozens and dozens, hundreds. And just recently, I think the Huffington Post did a big profile of his songs about towns and cities. So millions of people have listened to those. He's been on a kick of like in every state in the union, mm-hmm. writing a song about every town, mostly sourced from just the Wikipedia page wherever those towns are.
I was recently scrolling through one of his albums about Iowa towns where I'm at. I'm just like looking through all the names of cities around me.
And the lyrics will be like, oh, the community center is a great place to be, you know, like whatever the most obvious landmarks are. So like he has had a fair amount of media coverage in this side of his career, almost all of it basically treating him as like a Spotify scammer, which I don't think he is.
No, I think he's someone who found a way to game the system enough to make enough money to be able to do the creative shit he wanted to do in the 100%. First place.
Yeah. And also I would just say too, that like he is living the dream. He's found the loophole that we all kind of wish we could find. But also it's a loophole that isn't really a loophole because he still has to do an enormous amount of work. like it's not exactly a get rich quick scheme. It's a get barely middle class over a very long period of time scheme. I like those songs. I think, you know, there is, you know, pick any random album by the band who was Paparazzi and the Photogs, which is his persona who does celebrity songs, or, you know, the guy who sings about animals or whatever. And like those songs are pretty fun. So I don't know. People who treat him as a scammer. A scammer. I'll tell you what the actual loophole is. The actual loophole is like writing one song that generates millions of dollars over years and years. The actual scam is writing like a Christmas song that gets played every Christmas and just being able to live off that.
Just cashing out the royalties every year.
Or worse, like your dad wrote that Christmas song. Right. And now you're still the... get. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the real scam. But so what Matt Farley's whole thing, if people aren't familiar with, is very early on, he figured out that it would be a smart idea to get his music on Spotify. And, you know, Spotify notoriously underpays their artists. I have some music on Spotify, right? And I've never seen the money it gets because it's like a couple cents per song, right? Mm-hmm. But if you upload 24,000 songs and you're getting a couple dollars a year per song, you have a middle class salary.
And not necessarily a couple dollars a year per song, but more like let's say 5% of his catalog gets a couple dollars a year. or like you know, if Billie Eilish posts about one of his songs, which I believe has happened, the Kardashians like were dancing to one of his songs at one point, you know, that song might go through the roof, and that'll you know, he'll get a bunch of money in a small amount of time for that one song.
Yeah.
And by a bunch of money, I mean, you know, like he can $50. Pay his rent for
like $100 or something. Yeah, of course. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's a really smart idea. And it has been kind of funny, like when I've looked, I poke around on YouTube related to Matt Farley, for instance, I will see that there are other people trying to do the Matt Farley thing. But the problem with that is Matt Farley, the reason it worked is because he was there first and early on and was doing it for a really long time.
Absolutely. It's a confluence of factors. Like, it's the remarkable discipline. I mean, he really is out there. Like days on end, just doing 120 songs a day. And you may say these songs are half-assed, you know, they're improvised. You try doing 120 half-assed songs in a day. It's not
easy.
Fucking easy. And then, just doing it over and over and over again for 10 years while also having a day job for most of that. And also just on top of it, like I do think, you know, one reason why a lot of the little kids who listen to his poop songs like it is I think they like his voice. You know, he has a very he has the right voice. Like he can actually do a lot with his voice, but he also has the right voice for those kinds of songs. He sounds friendly and approachable. You know,
Yeah, yeah, he carries himself that way in general, I feel like. Like, you know, so much of his shtick is partially like this kind of over-exaggerated narcissism, but he's also like super nice about it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to, you know.
I mean, the two sides of that kind of feed into each other, because he very genuinely, like if, you know, the narcissism, which, yeah, let's call it that. Why not? I think that's fair.
I'm trying to say it in the most neutral way possible, though. Yeah, like, it's not, because Matt is probably already listening to this, probably.
he definitely is. Because that's the thing. It's like he is, you know, nobody is nicer to their fans than him.
Yeah.
Nobody is more generous. Like, truly, he puts his phone number in his movies, and if you call him, he'll have an actual conversation with you. If you ask to meet him somewhere, he'll go meet you. Incredibly generous. And yeah, the narcissistic side is that it's like, oh yeah, it's all about him, isn't it? yeah. and the movies, which I love so much, you know, what is most personal is oftentimes the most universal. And like, he's figured out a way to sort of dramatize his own struggles, you know, his own creativity in a way that speaks to a very universal truth.
I mean, that's the thing that I found really fascinating about Moturn, and, you know, kind of moving into the movies here, is that, like, you know, the first movie I saw, like most people, if they do, you know, they do explore Moturn, and I also, this is probably the place you should start if you haven't listened or if you haven't watched them before, but it is River Beast, right? Don't Let the River Beast Get You. I don't know if you had told me while watching Don't Let the River Beast Get You, which was incredibly funny, and I just didn't know what was happening with that movie. It's such a bizarre artifact. If you had told me while I was watching that, this guy's going to make movies that will make you tear up at some point. Like, I wouldn't have really quite understood that, because they're so goofy. And yet, even as he gets into Local Legends and a lot of the newer ones, I don't know, the goofiness stays. And yet it's got this like heart to it that I don't know.
It's interesting when you look at the Letterboxd reviews of Don't Let the River Beast Get You, which is the one that's kind of come closest to becoming like a cult movie. It's reached an audience beyond my podcast, basically.
Right.
and that's great. And you see people like all over the place starting to discover it. And reading the Letterboxd reviews is interesting, because a lot of people don't have the language and don't have the frame of reference to sort of understand it, or not understand it. I think they do understand it, but they can't articulate it. And so you'll see all sorts of people who are sort of like, well, they have a very kind of dichotomous thinking of good and bad. And then if it's not one of those, it's so bad, it's good. And you see a lot of people trying to figure out exactly what substance this is made out of, and it's like, yeah, it's bad, but it's really self-aware, and it's actually like really clever. You see a lot of that. Yeah. And there are a lot of people on like Letterboxd or any of these platforms who also just flat out don't get it. They see it and they
yeah,
they can't get past the wall of like, the acting's really bad in this, it doesn't look like a real movie.
Yeah, yeah, because I mean, I was hit with that with River Beast. Is I was like, this looks like a long YouTube sketch, but right. Like now I don't know, that's grown on me.
Well, I still very vividly remember watching it. My friend Peter Kaplowski had a he's a festival programmer, and he had a festival, a little weekend festival in Toronto in I think 2015, where he would show movies that he couldn't get programmed into real festivals, you know, stuff that he'd advocated for, and he just couldn't get it through. And one of them was River Beast. And I remember it starting and thinking, oh God, you know, because it had that YouTube video look.
Yeah, that digital. Then, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very digital. And then within about like 10 or 15 minutes, there was something about like the language that they were all speaking, and that was so, you know, my tutor was an indecorous deviant, you know, stuff like that. But then coming out of the mouths of all these people who are just like obviously like very like not entertainment industry affiliated, but also like not Tim and Eric New England people, like somebody like people like Tim and Eric will often go to, you know, go to weird casting calls and find like the strangest, the weirdest, like showbiz wannabes. None of the people in the Moturn movies are show business wannabes. They're just people. And the movie, you know, as it was going on, I thought, oh, this is like really interesting. It's like, it's sort of playing into the normality of these people, for want of a better word, but also like not making fun of them, like celebrating it. It's sort of like it feels like just a big like backyard community barbecue movie. And then there came a point like 2/3 of the way in where I started feeling like, wait, I really care about these characters, like, you know. And then towards the end, when like Kevin McGee as a former professional athlete, Matt Stone, former professional athlete, Frank Stone, not the South Park, Frank Stone, comes to fight the river beast and says, get ready for the beatdown of your life. I just remember thinking like, oh my God, like I love the arc of this character and I care about him so much. I don't know. Like it was a really transcendent experience. And I just wanted to like shout it from the rooftops. And you go on Letterboxd, you'll often see people who have the exact same experience. And so like when people ask like what's the one you should watch first, I part of me wants them to watch River Beast, because it's like if you can have that experience, you'll be a fan for life.
You'll get hooked. Yeah.
And then but then it's like, oh, if you don't have that experience, Local Legends is the one that like I have trouble imagining anybody disliking.
It's just straightforwardly explaining Matt Farley's thing, you know. Yeah. That's the one for those who don't know. It's a black and white film that he's made that's kind of feels like kind of a parody of like a Woody Allen movie or something, that kind of autobiographical feel. But it's about Matt Farley, you know, and his Spotify trick that he's used to get money, and his, you know, wanting to make movies that nobody understands. And, you know, like, I don't know, there's so many scenes in that movie where, you know, he's showing his art to someone else and they're just not remotely interested. And I think if you are a creative person of any sort, you've had this experience before.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a movie about sort of, how hard it is to be an artist in a world that like is completely indifferent to your art, but also how doing that art making, if you are a creative person, that is still the most important thing in the world. And a lot of the movie, it's this autobiographical self-portrait, semi-autobiographical, where he just gives you, you know, the soup to nuts of his creative process. And it's structured around the buildup to this show that he's going to do, this New England comedy performance thing that a bunch of people are going to be at. And as the movie goes along, it's like, oh, it's going to be in a 1500 seat auditorium. Well, actually it's going to be at a bar. Well, actually it's going to be at a basement. actually we can't pay. Can I borrow $20? Because you know, the sound guy needs money. And it comes down to the conclusion that, like, you know, if you're a creative person, like, you'll probably never make it, but also just the act of creativity itself, you know, the doing the show in the basement for the audience of five people and having a good time with those five people, like, and then if there's no five people, just having a good time with yourself, like, that's what it's all about. So it's just an incredibly like clear-eyed and powerful, I think, movie about you know, creativity.
Let's put a pin in that, because I think we'll come back to that subject with a lot of the newest movies have that same theme, but they're like elaborating on it from a more mature kind of mature place as they've gotten older. But before we go to those, I guess in general, for people who aren't familiar, what are like most of their movies like? They're like these genre parodies, right?
I mean, they start that way. I mean, they're kind of like, I would compare them to, imagine the movies that you made as a with a camcorder when you were a kid, you know, in your parents' backyard. And, you know, you got your dad to play the villain and you got your uncle to play, you know, a supporting character, because those were the actors at your disposal. And then imagine you grew up, you went to college, you came back, and then you kept making those movies with the same people. but and they were the same kinds of movies, but you brought with you, you know, everything you learned in college, basically. So the movies are very self-aware, like they're comedies for the most part. They're comedies, and they make amateurishness a virtue. They're kind of partly about their own amateurishness, and they're also like community enterprises, because over the years, Farley and Charlie Roxburgh, who directs the movies and co-writes them, they've developed this kind of Altman-esque repertory company of, you know, actors, you know, co-stars, cousins, uncles, wives, brother and sister-in-laws, kids increasingly, who have just kind of anybody who's willing to be in the movies for a weekend. And I think the last thing I would say on style is that they're all, the dialogue is always this sort of like very overwritten, very loquacious, you know, very wordy kind of dialogue, that sounds, that often, and often there's a friction between like the actors and the dialogue. Like many of them are obviously sort of like learning it as if phonetically. And nobody, everybody is aware that it's funny, but nobody is like bad on purpose, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because isn't it how he does it is like when they're recording somebody speaking, it's just, you know, someone off camera just reads the line to them and then asks them to repeat it. And then,
oftentimes, and that is as much by necessity as by any aesthetic project, because they are, you know, these people are not getting paid. And so a lot of them are just, and you know, it's funny, as the movies go on, you see them get older and you see like some of them start to have kids, some of them start to have families. And so it gets harder and harder for them to come out on a weekend. So increasingly the movies will be built around, well, we're going to go to Sharon Scalzo's house and film her at her house while her daughter, who has separation anxiety, does not leave her mother's side. And then we're going to figure out a way to like incorporate the daughter into the story. And like all of that, you know, all of that is to be convenient to the actors, but then also ends up feeding into the art and enriching the art.
Yeah. It gives it a really specific look. So their films start out in the early days, really like the, I think actually in Mo Turn, they refer to them as the practice films, right? The first like six films that, I mean, I don't think you really could have found them a few years ago, but now through the Gold Ninja releases, that your co-host has done. And then I think
some of them
are
online a little bit too.
Druid Gladiator.
Druid Gladiator.
That one just hit TV. I mean,
Matt Farley and Charlie Roxburgh met in college and they bonded over, both, you know, loving old horror movies and, enjoying making backyard movies, and they sort of bonded over that and made short films all through college, made their first, I guess, what you could sort of call a feature film, The Paperboy, which I don't know if you've seen that one.
I still haven't seen that one. Yeah.
It's pretty funny. Like it's shot around the dorm and there are all these scenes where like, you know, Matt Farley plays a superhero called The Paperboy who does writes people's papers for them. And there are a lot of scenes where like he knocks on someone's door and he's got like underwear in his head. That's his disguise. And he, you know, hands them the paper and then they close the door. And you can see the people on the other side of the door, like laughing, you know, like they're being dragged into this filming experience, like kicking and screaming, and they're barely in the scene, but like, that's okay. And it's amazing. Like The Paperboy, I love The Paperboy. I think it like really announces their style, like pretty fully formed.
Yeah.
And then for the next, you know, 4 or 5 years, they made, half a dozen or so movies with just a mini DV camera, like the Druid Gladiator clone, Obtuse Todd, movies that are, you know, genuinely like quite amateurish in a lot of ways, just in a technical sense, but still I think have their their personality, have their sense of humor pretty forcefully in them already.
Oh yeah, they're the only of the pre Freaky Farley ones I've watched thus far is Adventures in Kruben County, or Country, not County. Is it County or Country?
Country, I think. Yes.
Country,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean it. You can see their sense of humor's there. You know, yeah. Like it's already, you know, working. But yeah, I think these are the ones you're supposed to, you know, for those who are listening who have never watched any Moturn Media, these are the ones you come to after you're hooked.
That's right. You're not supposed to start with those ones, and they've sort of kept them out of public view. Like they're on the Gold Ninja discs if you go looking for them. Druid Gladiator Clone is probably like the easiest of those early movies. And then Druids Everywhere is probably the most challenging of them. Like that's one that the real sickos like. I love it. But it's genuinely like as stripped down as one of these movies gets.
Yeah, they're kind of buried in that, even the Blu-ray release, where, you know, if you don't know, yeah, they're bonus features, you know, they're not the main thing. So it's yeah, for the real heads are digging for those. But the beginning of the era that I think of as kind of like their iconic era, because this is when people get hooked onto them, it's usually in this stuff, is, you know, Freaky Farley, Monsters, Murder, and Marriage in Manch Vegas, Don't Let the River Beast Get You, and then Local Legends, like that kind of era.
Well, with Freaky Farley, they actually got a 16mm movie camera and they shot it on film. So
it looks amazing, you know, for that reason.
Actually, does look kind of great, actually. And, these movies are, you can tell that there's a concerted effort here to like maybe go to the next level, maybe get some of these movies shown on the festival circuit. So Freaky Farley is one that is marketable, I suppose, or theoretically is marketable for like genre film festivals. It's a slasher parody / pastiche, kind of inspired by stuff like Silent Night, Deadly Night, Part 2. I think that's their big creative touchstone on that. And it's the that one... that was the one that my friend Peter actually saw originally. He was screening movies for the Toronto After Dark Film Festival, and he saw it without any context whatsoever. And that movie is less jokey than some of the ones that come after. The humor in it has more to do with just the general tone of it, kind of the bizarre acting styles and the strange things, you know, some of the strange things that happen that aren't necessarily jokes, but are funny. And I remember he said that like he kind of couldn't believe this movie and, you know, got in touch with Charlie Roxburgh to tell him like, you know, I just wanted to see what your deal was. Like, I really liked this movie. I can't get them to play it, but, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. And Charlie told us when we were writing that book that it was like, oh yeah, you know, for years we weren't getting any recognition at all. And we'd say, oh yeah, that guy from Canada liked it.
At least he liked it.
But this is actually kind of one of the things that always moved us about Matt and Charlie, was that they made these movies that were just like increasingly ambitious. You know, they're amateurish in a way, but like they're also, you know,
ambitious. Yeah,
like huge casts, you know, full-bodied five-act stories, locations all over the place, and it would build up and build up, and you know, actors would keep coming back over and over again as if there was somebody watching. And until about like, I don't know, 2020 or whatever, like nobody was watching. And we always found that moving, like to create an empire like this, as if like, oh, there's fan favorite Kevin McGee coming back, you know, to a completely empty audience. I think like Peter told me that he went to the first Moturn Extravaganza, which is this, you know, event that he holds for himself every year in Danvers, Massachusetts. And like there was a walking tour of filming locations, and it was Peter and two other people and Matt, and they were doing this walking tour, and like, you know, some of the cast members, like Sharon Scalzo, would show up and be like, oh, hey, it's Sharon Scalzo. And all this for an audience of three people.
Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Man, I would love to see one of those tours now that I've seen a lot of these movies.
Have you been to the extravaganza?
I have not. I'm out in Iowa, and so it's a bit of a journey. I would love to at some point.
I finally bit the bullet and went last year. Bit the bullet by which I mean, you know, I shelled out the money for the plane tickets and the rental car. I had a great time, you know, so I highly recommend it. It's like entering this complete alternate reality where, like, you know, I think there were probably 120 people there. And for the 120 people in that room, like when Kevin McGee comes in, it's as if, you know, Taylor Swift showed up. It's like everybody goes, you know. And there's like a huge line to take a picture with Kevin McGee. One guy had a Kevin McGee tattoo. You know, it's just a complete alternate reality.
I think you've mentioned that you felt genuinely starstruck meeting Kevin McGee.
Oh yeah, I was genuinely starstruck meeting Kevin McGee. Like, yeah, I remember I there was a line to take a picture with him, and I shook his hand and he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, I'm from Toronto." And he said, "Oh yeah, Matt has a big Canadian following. I think there were some guys who wrote a book about him from there." And I was like, "Oh, that was me. That was me. And he looks like completely nonplussed, you know, just not impressed at all.
It's like, why would someone write a book about this?
Yeah. Yeah.
God, that's amazing. Actually,
Kevin McGee was so great at the extravaganza because, you know, most of Matt and Charlie's, you know, stock company were there for, you know, a couple hours. But Kevin McGee shows up 15 minutes before he sings his song, you know, like Frank Sinatra. Yeah, he shakes some hands, goes for some pictures, gets up on stage, does his songs, kills another 10 minutes of photos, then he leaves, you know. Again, amazing. Chairman of the board, love it.
Oh my god. Well, so yeah, I mean, let's talk a little bit about Kevin McGee real quick. Like, I don't know, I guess in general, one thing that's really cool about Moturn is kind of, you know, what we've been circling here is there is almost like an ironic sense of celebrity built into so much of what they've built. Like, you know, I mean, Matt Farley's own persona being like, I'm the greatest artist ever. You know,
it reminds me in a weird way of like Andy Warhol and his Superstars, or John Waters and the Dreamlanders, you know, the way that those people would like build, you know, personae around themselves and sort of will it into existence until it actually became true.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean,
the joke, like, with them, as it is similarly with Matt, is that it's like, yeah, but in a million years, they wouldn't actually be stars through like a normal system, you know,
right?
The actual gatekeepers wouldn't let them through. So like, let's make our own Hollywood.
Yeah. Make our own Hollywood in our backyards. You know, like, that's, yeah, I mean, that's why I find them just so genuinely moving at times, is because, yeah, I mean, there is a sense that, like, I mean, if you are a creative person, the likelihood of, if I started making movies in my backyard, that I would end up at Hollywood, very, very low, very, very, very low, barring some, you know, accident of some sort. But I love the Moturn Media kind of approach of just like defiance to that. It's like, no, we are stars out here, you know.
That's right.
Like, and so, like, yeah, Kevin McGee has this presence. It's kind of sad that he wouldn't have been in movies. You know what I mean? It's cool that he is in movies, because he would have just been a guy in New England. But in his movie, in the movies, when he makes his appearance, he has a real movie star characteristic to him, like a sort of I don't know, a big presence on stage or on screen.
Oh yeah. And if people don't know, Kevin McGee was Matt Farley's boss at his day job for 15-17 years. For a long time, Matt worked at a group home for unhoused or underprivileged youth. And Kevin McGee was his manager there. And I think McGee had harbored at one time, you know, a long, long time ago, maybe some ambitions. Like, he'd gone to New York and tried out for Broadway. Oh, okay. Didn't really work out, but he, you know, lives an entirely happy and fulfilled life in New England now. But he always, you know, I think he, maybe more than some of the other ones, likes acting. He was always sort of happy to, you know, take part during lunch hours. It is funny though, like, I get the sense that, you know, he likes acting, but he also like, you know, likes having dinner as well. So a lot of the structure, a lot of the shooting days are sort of built around, okay, my wife's away for 3 hours this afternoon. You boys can come over here as long as you film at my house, and got to be done by 5:30. But yeah, you're right. He does have a very like strong, like almost like Clint Eastwoodian presence at times, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And you see that in the plot, what you described there with a lot of the movies, where it's just every time they are meeting McGee, you know, Kevin McGee's character, it just so happens to be in his backyard, obviously. But it never like disrupts the flow of the story, really. And it always works really nicely. I think that's part of what's often really impressive about them, is that they build these scripts around the limitations that are just, you know, built into working around people's schedules or whatever, but it doesn't ever feel like forced. It doesn't feel like while you're watching it, you're thinking, oh, that's why they're filming there. You know, they Absolutely. Do a good job. Yeah. Keeping it flowing. Well, tonally, right after Freaky Farley, they kind of got like lighter in tone for a while, partially because you mentioned in Moturn that they mention in it that Freaky Farley was too dark, and the entire audience was their families. And so
it would have been great if it actually got into a festival, but it never did. So, you know, the only public screening was to an audience of people in their 50s.
Yeah. So they a lot of those the movies in that iconic era right after Freaky Farley don't have that same grit that like but you know, it gets replaced with something else that I don't know. I think the kind of almost family friendly goofiness of them, I don't dislike that. Like I look forward to one day having kids and showing them like Don't Let the River Beast Get You. You know what I mean?
Well, one of the things that's funny, about Don't Let the River Beast Get You is it comes kind of marketed as a horror movie, and it has that opening scene of the guy in the chair saying, you know, the river beast, you're very William Castle, like, oh, it's whatever the red light flashes on screen, close your eyes because the river beast is too frightening. But the river beast is barely in it, and you know, it sort of makes a point about how beside the point the river beast itself is. And the fact that, you know, the films from that point on like have very little violence, no nudity, you know, none of the exploitable elements that you would expect from an exploitation film. They don't even swear, you know. Matt is very morally opposed to swearing.
You know, that created a really weird thing when I watched Metal Detector Maniac for the first time recently. And when it's, I think it's Skizzy, when he just says piss, it like made me jump.
Yeah.
Part of it is also that, like they're what they love in old horror movies and stuff is not the same thing as most people who are horror fans love. And it's given me new lenses to like how I look at, I don't know, you know, regional horror movies or whatever. Is, you know, they love those 50s horror movies that have the title that it doesn't remotely live up to, you know, like
I think they also even like in, you know, the Friday the 13th movies, they like the scenes that Jason isn't in. They just like teenagers hanging, you know, by the lake.
Yeah, that's always the like kind of thing about slashers, is usually there's like five really awesome scenes and then a lot of really boring shit in the middle. And they love the boring shit in the middle. They love the like after school special feel. I mean, you just, all of their movies feel like that kind of that between the action kind of just mundane stuff. But it's really funny. It's hard, because when I'm saying this, I feel like it isn't a good selling point to somebody who's never, but it's funny. You know?
I would emphasize that it's funny.
It's very funny. Yeah. And that they're trying to be funny, because I think that's also something when you go in blind, you often don't realize that they're trying, because they don't wink at the camera. They don't.
I honestly find that's the reaction that baffles me the most from people. And it's common enough that I guess I can't dismiss it, but there are a lot of people, you'll see them review it like, I think this is funny on purpose. And it's like, you know, my teacher was an indecorous deviant. Like, you don't write that and not think it's funny.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so many of the lines are just clearly these like kind of building jokes over time. Mm-hmm. They get latched onto phrases they think are funny, figures of speech they think are funny. Like, I think it's in Heard She Got Murdered. Is it the promoter who's running the like venue they're going to play at wants a beefy sound,
right?
Which is a really funny, like I, you know, that's something I would say about like a guitar tone or whatever. But like, if I'm actually trying to describe what a beefy sound in a song is, I couldn't tell you.
But or the running gag River Beast of like, oh, Bradley, his son from another marriage, which they keep saying over and over again, which is like such a funny and like emotionally distant way to describe a human being, like his son from another marriage. just hearing them say it over and over again as if it's a normal thing you would say. Well, actually, that's one thing I really remember from my first viewing of River Beast. At the end of the movie, when he says, and we're gonna raise Bradley, her deceased ex-fiance's son from another marriage, as if he were our own, and it cuts to Bradley watching at home, just like cheering.
That's so good.
I remember that blowing my mind. Yeah,
that whole scene at the end of River Beast, which, you know, I don't want to spoil the, you know, probably the best joke in that, but mm-hmm. you know, like in general, like that whole scene is hilarious because it's, you know, it sounds like it's this big momentous moment, but it's this clearly this conference room that's like at third full and it's supposedly being televised.
The art direction of that scene is
incredible.
Low-key, like, and I think it takes a couple of viewings to fully appreciate how perfect it is. The fact that there are just a few like really sad balloons on the floor. and what like Charlie is doing with the camera, just it's always these like really flat medium shots that without calling attention to it and without seeming to try, just emphasize how sad the room is. You know, any trick that you would use to make the room look impressive, it does not use. But yeah, it also like doesn't seem to be trying to do that. Like it's really, you know, I throw around the word amateurish in describing these movies, but like they truly know what they're doing.
Right. They're embracing the look of amateurishness, but like if you pay attention to the mm-hmm. camera angles and the editing, it's not amateurish at all.
No,
like,
no.
They know what they're doing. I think personally my favorite era of their stuff thus far is what they've been doing since 2020. Mm-hmm. Is this black and white period. I don't remember if we were recording or not when I said I'm trying to avoid using the phrase late period to talk about these movies, but because I hope they make more, but they've been really, really fascinating since 2020. And part of that is because I feel like they're zooming back into a lot of the themes that were in Local Legends, but still plugging them into the kind of genre parody stories overall. But they are a more matured look on, like, you know, Local Legends is create, you should do it regardless. And that's still the message of the later movies, but it's complicated. It starts getting complicated because these later movies are, okay, we're still making these backyard movies. What does a backyard movie look like when it's made by somebody who's approaching middle age?
Mm-hmm. And you can see
that's
like
amazing.
Yeah, there's like... And in these movies, which when you start making a lot of movies, when you start making two movies a year, it becomes more like a flow. You know, there are certain very prolific directors like Hong Sang-soo or Woody Allen or Jess Franco, very disparate directors, you know, very different directors, but like something they have in common is the fact that like, because they're producing so relentlessly, certain themes get repeated and repeated. And it almost becomes like a back and forth, like the filmography becomes a dialogue with itself, which, you know, is interesting. Yeah. It's very much in opposition to like the Kubrickian model of like, oh, ruminating over your next big statement for the 7 to 10 years and then making it. And in these movies, yeah, it's like Local Legends is point, and then Heard She Got Married is counterpoint, and then Magic Spot is another volley kind of from the opposite direction. And then Hirschi Got Murdered. Like, Hirschi Got Married, which was their first movie since Slingshot Cops. So it was their first movie in 5 years. I remember being quite taken aback by the tone of it, which is much more dramatic than the other ones.
Hirschi Got Married is, I really liked Moturn Media before I saw that one, but that was the one, I watched it for the first time last year in the fall, and that was the one that I was like, I love these guys. These guys are amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, I really appreciate these recent films have been kind of pulling back a bit. They've been grounded a little more for the most part. There's been exceptions to that. Grounded for Moturn, I'll say. Mm-hmm. They're more grounded. And so because of that, the like awkward jokes just deliver harder for me. And also the sadness that you wouldn't notice in maybe the earlier films seems like there. Like Hirschi Got Married is it's got a lot of reflections on art that I found just really, really moving because yeah, it's got the local legends thing. It's good to create, but also I don't know. No, you know what happens when it's been 10, 20 years now and nobody's taking me seriously.
Well, most of the movies that you see are by people who have made it, you know? And so it's easy for them to make movies that say like, follow your dreams. The default of movies is that they sort of hook into like a success narrative. Or, you know, Inside Llewyn Davis, something like that is sort of like that's a noble movie about failure, that sort of says it's okay. Like it's okay to be a failure. It's understandable to be a failure. Mm-hmm. But Hirschi Got Married sort of begins at the point where he's failed. Like he's back in his hometown, having gone to the big city and it's not quite worked out. And then what do you do from there? And it's a different vantage point from Local Legends, where, you know, he's still like he's in his early 30s as opposed to his late 30s mm-hmm. or his early 40s. There's still hope, you know? But then what do you do when there's no hope anymore? You know?
Yeah.
Well, you gotta keep creating, because to not create is to die. But then how do you recalibrate your expectations? What is it you're creating for at that point?
Yeah.
And in that movie, you know, it's it is, as you say, more grounded. A lot of the drama comes from, you know, this new friend that he makes, his mailman, who becomes his bass player, who may or may not be a sort of Tyler Durden-esque, like, externalization of all of his frustrations and disappointments, you know? Mm-hmm. Just talking about like the style of it too, it's not like, it is funny, but it's not as sort of jokey as some of the earlier ones. And the acting is still the same. The dialogue is kind of the same, but it's tapping into a different mood. It's a little more disquieting than it is ha ha funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a weird one to watch. Like I think part of the magic trick of that one is best if you've watched a bunch of their movies prior to it, because once you watch that one, there's a point when you start to kind of be like, where are the jokes? And I don't mean that in a negative way. It starts to really, the absence of jokes, which if it was the first movie of theirs you ever saw, wouldn't stick out to you. But
I think the scene where he, you know, meets Elizabeth, I'm forgetting what her character's name is, you know, his real life wife on the deck, to say something like, look, would things have ever worked out between us? And she says no, and he says, that's fine, I just needed to hear that. Like that's such a powerful scene, don't you think? Like, doesn't it just hit you? Yeah.
One of my favorite scenes in that is right after, I think it's the first show they play, with the kind of new duo they have, Matt Farley's character and then the mailman, right? And he's talking to and it sounds like the mailman had never played a show before. And so he's just, it, you know, you see the show and it's got like five people in the audience. It's not like a big show or anything. But then afterwards, he's like, that's the most alive I've ever felt. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like you know, I played in like, you know, in high school in like a punk band in bars to audiences of like two or three people. Like, I know that feeling.
It's
very personal. It hit me on a really personal note when I saw it for the first time.
And it's an interesting counterpoint to the basement concert scene in Local Legends too, which that scene sort of begins pathetic, but ends triumphantly. And there's a feeling of like strong togetherness in that scene. But the concert in Heard She Got Married, I don't know, like he says it's the most alive he's felt, but there's also like a strong melancholy all throughout that scene.
Yeah. Cause I mean, Matt replies to him like, yeah, I used to, I think he says fill up stadiums or whatever. Mm-hmm. And imagine that feeling you're having times 10, you know, like, And so there's an implied like, and now that's not the case for me anymore.
Right.
You know, and I think there might be something, if you want to project kind of current eventsy stuff onto the films a bit, like Local Legends, yeah, has this moment of everybody coming together in a space and like, oh, we're triumph, you know, that triumphant feel of like this kind of disaster show that ends up being a blast. As Heard She Got Married feels like it's definitely a post-COVID movie where like, you know, like we can't really have the big gatherings anymore, you know, like now it's not the case, but like at the moment it came out, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Definitely like the COVID, the pandemic experience like seeps into the atmosphere and the production of the movie in a lot of different ways.
Well, the movie they were working on, during COVID, right, was the one that they had the hardest time, like, working on because of all that, was Metal Detector Maniac, right? Was that the one that they...
They were experimenting with a different production model with that because Slingshot Cops was their most ambitious movie just in terms of scale. And, you know, I think everybody had new kids at that moment and there were just a lot of, like... a lot of obligations and the former model was becoming unsustainable. So they were experimenting on Metal Detector Maniac with a model of like, let's meet on a weekend, you know, every two or three months and record some scenes. And then that was disrupted by the pandemic, which barred interstate travel for a time. But then as well, I think during that period, they also started to get a larger audience for their movies, which is still not an enormous audience, but like,
no, but a bit of a cult following.
They were getting a real cult following. And so, they hit upon a new model of sort of filming, just very quickly and very inexpensively and sort of within like a couple of week period.
I actually watched Metal Detector Maniac for the first time this last week, and it might be a recency bias thing, but I think it might be my favorite film of theirs.
I mean, it's really funny, you know.
It is the one that I think I've laughed, at least I can say I laughed the hardest at that one.
I like that movie too is like a kind of it's one of the best articulations of their creative philosophy. So in this last run of movies, there's the push-pull of, you know, is it worth it to create, but I must create, but is it worth it to create, but I must create. But also on running throughout these movies, this philosophy of artistic creation, which is that like creation is very important and the act of creation is very important. And the act itself is more important than the end result or the, you know, the technical niceties of all of it. So in that movie, it's like they hit on this model of like really fast. The whole movie is built around their songwriting, which is just like I think they call it like marathon songwriting, just song after song after song after song. Mm-hmm. And just the treadmill of it is the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, part of what I love about that movie, too, is that the songs actually serve as really good expositional ways to like go to the next part of the plot or kind of comment on where they're at in the plot. And yeah, it just builds up to an incredibly funny final 20 minutes or so. But, you know, the general gist, you know, without spoiling the ending, is it's these two who are, it's just, yeah, Matt Farley and Tom Scalzo, they just play their own with their own names. Right. And they're on sabbatical as music professors.
They play an alternate reality version of themselves who are so successful that they've become professors at a college. Yeah.
Yes. and they are they're on sabbatical to write a write an album, and while they're playing basketball, they notice that there's a guy with a metal detector in the park, and then they just get into a diluted series of assumptions about this guy, assuming that he must be a murderer. They must be in kind of a slasher situation, and he just hasn't been found out, and they just consistently stir up shit in the town. And I think it's kind of interesting because it's one of the few of their movies where it's not like the whole world is crazy, like in the same way, like usually like in River Beast or Magic Spot or whatever, everyone in the world feels in on the joke. You know, everyone's talking in this stylized way or whatever. What's interesting about, you know, Metal Detector Maniac is that those two are the ones who are acting in this like highfalutin way, but the rest of the characters are just kind of annoyed with them. And I think that juxtaposition is what I find so funny in that movie. But
yeah, totally.
Well, yeah, in general, they've got kind of I feel like their aesthetic and their approach to art is just really contagious, and I think that's why I've continued to find them. Like I don't think, you know, making a podcast or something like that is a very different art form than what they do, but I see what they're doing and it inspires me to want to do more, you know, with whatever I do creatively. And I know that like their kind of approach was kind of an inspiration for you behind even just writing the book Moturn on Moturn.
Certainly. I mean, I was I had a day job at that time that I didn't like very much. And I was very, was feeling the weight on my shoulders of like, oh God, you know, all the things one has to do to earn money to live in this world. And I thought, you know, this was right at the start of the pandemic. And I thought, you know, it'd be a really like funny punk gesture to spend an enormous amount of time writing a book for no audience, you know. and this was, yeah, it was like March 2020, and the Spectacle Theater in New York was doing this online retrospective that I think Peter and Justin had worked with on them of the Matt and Charlie movies. And so every week they would play a double feature of their movies, one of the old ones and one of the newer ones, and there'd be this like chat function, you know. And it was very heartwarming to see, like, you know, audiences of, I don't know, 100-120 people, certainly larger audiences than they'd ever had at one time for any of their movies before, you know, having a great time with the movies. And as the weeks went on, you know, Kevin McGee would show up and everybody in the chat would be like, yes, Kevin McGee. And Matt and Charlie would be in the chat sort of saying, you know, giving little behind the scenes production tidbits. And there was one moment in Local Legends where I think Sharon Scalzo has her wedding ring on in the movie. And someone says, why does this character who's single have a wedding ring? And Charlie said, better to have them wearing their ring than like lose an hour of a shooting day trying to find a lost wedding ring. And I thought, God, that's the kind of insight that needs to be between the covers of a book. So yeah. I said to Justin, like, wouldn't it be funny if we did Bergman on Bergman or Hitchcock Truffaut, but for Matt Farley and Charlie Roxburgh? And he said, I love the idea. And yeah, that there was, I was very sustained, like, you know, having it sort of as a given that, you know, this has no audience, was such a funny and kind of liberating way to approach a project. I don't know. Actually, as it turns out, the book hasn't had a huge audience, but it's had an audience. Like,
I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, in some ways, I think it's the most personally meaningful project I've ever done. I also think in some ways it is like, of all the things I've done, it's the one that has contributed something to film scholarship in its way, you know, like, and I hope that for the people who have read it, you know, it sort of lives on in them.
Yeah. I mean, thus far, I've gotten a lot out of the book and out of, you know, you being able to share, you know, Moturn's kind of approach, you know, philosophy about art to, I don't know, people like me who are doing what we're doing, you know, who are making stuff for mostly no one.
Well, the Moturn method, which is its own book now, as I'm sure you know, has been enormously influential to me, because I do think it sort of liberates one to pursue projects, you know, to stop worrying. Like one of the kind of liberating things about what Local Legends says is, you know, nobody cares about your art. And so the downside of that is obvious, but the upside is nobody cares if you make something really stupid just for yourself. Nobody really cares if you fail. And so that liberates you to kind of do whatever you want. So I think that's definitely informed me in terms of things like, you know, I put together last fall a zine about the Three Stooges, and I just put a call out on my social media feeds. Anybody who has any Stooge related stuff, please send it to me and I'll put it in a zine. And that ended up being an enormously rewarding project. And I'm not sure I would have done that had I not been influenced by the example set forth by them.
Yeah. I mean, that's you mentioned when you were pitching the book to Justin initially, that phrase, wouldn't it be funny if? And I know that's in general kind of just Moturn's philosophy, right? Is wouldn't it be funny if, you know, and you know, that manifests for them in like Slingshot Cops, right? You know, wouldn't it be funny if there was a buddy cop movie with your uncle as one of the cops, or, you know, whatever. But I see, like, it kind of makes perfect sense that your careers would collide with theirs, because, I mean, Michael and Us kind of feels like that was initially how that started, right? It was, wouldn't it be funny 100%. If we made a podcast about Michael Moore?
100%. And as there is, in fact, I think in the Moturn method, a chapter called "Wouldn't It Be Funny If," which he says something like, you know, if you have a ridiculous idea, an idea so ridiculous no one would ever do it, you have to do that project because the best thing that can happen is you can become an absolute legend. And then even if you don't, people might say, hey, remember that guy who did that really crazy project? And I genuinely think, like, it's taken me a long time to realize this, but wouldn't it be funny if has been one of the guiding principles of my career. That's a grand word for it, but let's call it that, my career. And I think it's good advice, you know? Wouldn't it be funny if those are the ideas that nobody else has done?
Yeah. And, you know, I think kind of part of why it's built into it is you think it's funny because you think it's ridiculous, but it's ridiculous because no one's done it. If someone had done it wouldn't feel ridiculous. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, trying to think if there's anything else specifically to say about. I mean, obviously, I could probably talk forever about Moturn, but I don't know. Is there anything that specific that comes to mind for you as we're kind of wrapping up?
Well, I think just the last thing I would say on Moturn is it kind of amazes me in retrospect that we wrote Moturn on Moturn, like before Hershey got married and Metal Detector Maniac and Magic Spot and, you know, Boston Johnny and that run of movies. Because I think they're only getting better. I think they've only gotten deeper, you know, Magic Spot, maybe their best movie. Honestly, it's really beautiful. And it sort of brings together everything they're about, all their themes in this perfect package. And one day, maybe the next time there's a global pandemic or they've made enough movies, I would love to do a sort of sequel book because, you know, as time goes on, I'm very pleased with that book. But as time goes on, it's like, it ends just as they're getting started, you know?
Yeah, it ends right with just a little bit about Metal Detector Maniac, which is in the works at the time, right? And I mean, actually they were following that wouldn't it be funny if mentality. They've been following it even more, it feels like, lately, because The Wouldn't It Be Funny If is also in part a reaction to their small cult following. Okay, we've gotten this cult following from these like genre parodies, like about, you know, kind of parodying like monster movies or slashers. What if we make The Magic Spot, which is basically just feels like a comfy Christmas movie?
And like, God bless them. It's amazing. It's incredible that they have no bosses, you know? There is nobody to veto this. You know, yeah, they're getting this cult following to the point where it is actually plausible that they could get a movie at, I don't know, Fantastic Fest or one of these festivals. And they've responded to that by not doing that, by making movies in black and white that don't have monsters. And it just makes you think, like if only the world could run like this, if only, you know, every artist, you know, every great filmmaker could have, you know, if only Spielberg or Scorsese or even like the really powerful ones just had the power to say, wouldn't it be funny if, and then, you know, got to do whatever they wanted.
Yeah. I mean, they've really, I wish more artists were able to do what they do, that they've built a small but devoted cult following that is interested in whatever they end up doing. And so because of that, they can almost kind of troll their own audience, but in a way that their audience loves. You know, like I, you know, kind of the black and white period being that it wouldn't it be funny if Hershey Got Married. It's not the goofy genre parodies anymore. Now it's really grounded and it kind of feels like a noir almost. It's sad. And then, okay, everyone actually really liked that and was moved by that. So let's make a sequel where it comes back into being a goofy genre thing. You know, with Hershey Got Murdered.
Or like Boston Johnny, which is, you know, built on this joke of wouldn't it be funny if a guy talked like this for a whole movie.
I still haven't seen Boston Johnny, but I do feel like I need to bring it up because that's the one that your name appears in, right? There's a character named Toronto's own Will Sloan.
Yeah, and I think that came up as a result of Justin did a Kickstarter campaign for Gold Ninja Video, and one of the prizes was that you could name a character in a Motown Media movie, and somebody, I don't know who, not me, somebody named a character Toronto's own Will Sloan. But it seems they really embraced it, and that's pretty great. I mean, again, I don't see Paul Thomas Anderson naming a character after me. I don't see David Fincher going out of his way to name a character after me, so...
All right. Well, as we wrap up here, is there anything you want to plug? I mean, obviously the podcasts, if anybody hasn't listened to them, do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah. The Important Cinema Club is a movie podcast co-hosted by my good buddy, Justin DeClue, about film history. Michael and Us is a culture and politics podcast hosted by my other good buddy, Luke Savage. Hmm. And I think that's all I need to plug right now.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much to you for joining me, and so much to everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. If you like what you heard, make sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It seriously helps me out with growing the show. And if you're new to the show, check out the back catalog. There's a lot of other episodes. If you really like the show, there is a Patreon for the show with 2 bonus episodes a month. You can find that in the show notes. And hey, speaking of Patreon, that brings us to our lovely patrons, who include Robert Heilman, Joseph Gross, Gavin Aronson, Steven, a.k.a. Spike Stonehand, The Worst of All Possible Worlds, Moss, Kyle Gannis, Regular Sized Horse, parentheses small, I Am Once Again, and of course, Chris Barker. Thank you to everyone for supporting the show and to you for listening. And I will see you later this week, probably, maybe next week, I don't know.